The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by IJ Senior Attorney Dan Albin and IJ Attorney Kirby West. Dan, let's kick things off in the Ninth Circuit.
Sure. Let's talk about West v. City of Caldwell, a case from my home county, Canyon County, Idaho, where I grew up. In this case, somewhat similar to Leck, the Tenth Circuit case that was discussed on the podcast a few weeks ago, the police were searching for a fugitive and entered a home in order to do so. In this particular case, they got the permission from the homeowner to do the search. She handed the keys to the police officer and nodded her head yes in consent to enter the home to search for the suspect. But what happened was rather different from what she probably expected. The police used a 12-gauge shotgun to fire multiple tear gas canisters into the house, putting holes in the doors, windows, walls, ceiling, and coating everything in tear gas. It made the home uninhabitable for several months. And she sued, seeking damages, and of course, the police said they were protected by qualified immunity. So this is another one of these qualified immunity cases that I think will provoke quite a bit of outrage about what happened. The Ninth Circuit found that, in fact, the police were entitled to qualified immunity because they ruled it is not obvious in the absence of a controlling precedent that defendants exceeded the scope of plaintiff's consent by causing the tear gas canisters to enter the house in an attempt to flush Salinas out into the open. Now, that's from the majority opinion. The dissent takes a somewhat different view. And I'd first just like to read briefly a description of what happened to the house from the dissent, because I think it captures how extreme these actions were by the police. West's personal belongings and the home itself were saturated in tear gas. Broken glass littered the floor. The walls and ceilings had gaping holes from contact with the tear gas canisters. In the aftermath of the destruction, West and her children could not live in their home for several months. Now, West brought several different claims in this case, each of which was defended on qualified immunity grounds by the Ninth Circuit. But I think the most interesting one is this consent claim. Did she really consent to the police destroying her house in a search for the fugitive, which, by the way, was her ex-boyfriend who had a long felony record and who they believed somewhat reasonably to still be in the house? When she handed her keys to the officer and nodded her head yes in response to the question, is it okay if we go into the house to look for the suspect? I don't think any reasonable person would think that when you hand your keys to someone and nod yes, you may go into a house to look for something, that you're consenting to the police essentially destroying your house, firing tear gas canisters, all of those sorts of things. You're probably much more reasonably consenting to the police using those keys to open the door and go inside. And here she was, had her house destroyed, put out of her house for several months. And the consent, I think, is just so far beyond what anyone would ever consent to. It's a crazy case.
As another IJ attorney put it, if it's a reasonable interpretation to invite someone into your home for them to then destroy your home, those officers certainly would not be invited to dinner at this other IJ attorney's home. And I think that's a good point. That's just not an interpretation that any rational person would have. I will say, though we share a last name, my sympathy for the plaintiff in this case is exclusively based on being a sane person and not any relation to the plaintiff. I think another interesting aspect of this case, besides obviously the scope of consent, which seems so clear that this was not within the scope of consent of what she anticipated the officers would do, is the voluntariness of the consent in the first place. The officers asked her if they could go in the home, and she initially was very reluctant to grant them access to her home. But they really laid on the pressure and said, you know, you could be in a lot of trouble if we find out that this guy is in there and you didn't tell us. And she knew that other people had suffered some really severe consequences for having people in their homes when, you know, they shouldn't have been there. And she felt really pressured to let the officers in the first place. And there's a lot of case law cited here that shows the office, you know, there's some clearly established precedent that if someone is really seriously pressured to allow officers to access their home, that's not truly voluntary consent to enter the home in the first place. I think that's another interesting issue.
Dan, was the suspect actually in the home?
So, as it turns out, the suspect was not in the home. I think the only creature in the home was the family dog. So, it turns out all of this was to no avail.
Was the dog okay?
As I understand it, yes, but I don't know any of the details. I suspect it was pretty traumatized by everything that happened. That's sort of the punchline to this whole story. After destroying the house, the police finally break down the door, go in, and it turns out the suspect's not there after all. Now, the facts of the case make it pretty clear that it wasn't crazy for them to think he might be there. There was information from the plaintiff's sister and grandmother that he had recently been at the house, possibly as recent as the past 30 minutes before the police arrived. So, they may have had a reasonable belief that he was still in the house, but some of the actions they took after they arrived, I think, go beyond any bounds of reason. Now, of course, this is a qualified immunity case. So the question isn't just what would a reasonable person be consenting to, or did they actually have voluntary consent from her to search the house? It's, whether the right was clearly established at the time of the conduct. And the problem is the courts have said, you can't have any level of generality. There has to be a directly on-point case that says, no, when someone hands you keys and says, yes, you may enter my house, that does not constitute, consent to destroy your house with tear gas canisters. Of course, you're never going to find that precedent if the courts keep doing this kind of sort of legal gymnastics to avoid ruling against the government. And there is, even within the current case law, a way in which courts can find that, okay, so, previously no one has ever interpreted, someone handing them keys as consent to fire tear gas canisters. The courts have said in the rare obvious case in which a general legal principle makes the unlawfulness of the officer's conduct clear, despite a lack of precedent, they can find that qualified immunity is waived. And the dissent in this case, West v. City of Caldwell, found that that this is precisely that sort of circumstance. They point out that the absence of precedent on this demonstrates that some police actions are so clearly unacceptable under the applicable standard that it is the absence of these cases that shows no reasonable officer could think that they would be authorized to do this sort of thing. And unfortunately, it was just one judge out of a 3-judge panel that felt that. But this is another case, I think, that illustrates the problems with qualified immunity precedent as it currently exists, and the need for the Supreme Court to take a look at qualified immunity and how it's immunizing officers from totally outrageous behavior that destroys people's lives.
Okay, let's move on to the next case, which comes out of Baltimore, Maryland. Kirby.
So the next case we're going to discuss is, as you said, a case that's going to be before the Court of Appeals of Maryland, which is the High Court in Maryland. And the case is Pizza De Joey and Madame Barbecue versus the mayor and the city council of Baltimore. This case may have been discussed on this podcast in the past, I'm not sure, but it's a food truck case, a food truck ban passed by the city of Baltimore, which prohibited the vending from food trucks within 300 feet of businesses that are primarily engaged in selling the same type of food product as the mobile vendor. This is problematic for a number of reasons, as the plaintiffs argued in this case. What, first of all, constitutes the same type of food product is a tricky question and subject to a wide variety of interpretations. And also, of course, the only justification for passing this ban, which became clear over the course of litigation, was the protection of brick-and-mortar restaurants from competition by mobile food vendors, which is impermissible under the Maryland Constitution. The circuit court agreed with the plaintiffs that there was a due process violation and that the ban was too vague. Again, that goes back to that broadness of interpretation of what constitutes the same type of food product. And they enjoined the ban. The Court of Special Appeals overturned and found that the plaintiffs were not entitled to bring this pre-enforcement facial vagueness challenge because what the right at issue was not a fundamental constitutional right. And this is a right under Article 24 of the Maryland Declaration of Rights, which states, "No man ought to be taken or imprisoned or deceased of his freehold, liberty, or privileges, or outlawed or exiled, or in any manner destroyed or deprived of his life, liberty, or property, but by judgment of his peers or by the law of the land." And that's known as the Law of the Land Clause. And the briefing in this case is really interesting. It goes back to the history of the Maryland Declaration of Rights and where this law of the land provision comes from. And as the brief explains, it comes from Magna Carta, but the framers of the law of the land provision made clear that they were trying to expand upon the privileges and the liberties that were at issue in Magna Carta. But because we're dealing with this really ancient history, we get to look back at some pretty, you know, ancient cases. There's a case from the 1500s that says that a innkeeper, though when he sets up shop next to another victualler or seller of victuals, though he takes business away from him, it's not a damage because he can't compel people to visit one shop or another. And then there's a case from the late 1300s in which a royal monopoly on the selling of wine in London was ruled illegal. And so looking at this history of from Magna Carta, it's clear that the right to pursue one's chosen trade is a fundamental right. And then taking into account that the framers of the Maryland Declaration of Rights intended to broaden the scope of those rights, it becomes even more clear that clearly the framers of the Declaration of Rights in Maryland intended the right to pursue one's chosen trade to be a fundamental right. And it's really unfortunate that a Maryland court would really fail so spectacularly in the protection of its own Declaration of Rights and upholding the state's protections of liberties that were intended to be broad. And there's a lot of other case law more specific to Maryland and more recent that shows that this is what was intended.
Dan?
We should probably point out that this is an IJ case that we've litigated from the very beginning. It's part of our broader economic liberty litigation and specifically our food truck freedom initiative, where across the country we're challenging protectionist regulations like this one that prevent food trucks from operating near restaurants, often in an attempt to completely exclude food trucks from the downtown area of a city. And that's what happened here. The evidence in this case included a map overlay of the city that showed all of the zones in which food trucks could not operate because of this proximity restriction. And effectively, all of downtown Baltimore was made unavailable by the operation of the law that's being challenged in this case.
Kirby, why are we doing this in state court rather than federal court?
Well, the Maryland Declaration of Rights, as I mentioned, provides really uniquely expansive protections for the right to pursue one's chosen trade. And it's important for state courts to really enforce the protections that are within their own state constitutions. And Marylanders are entitled to the full protection of the Declaration of Rights, including Article 24. And this building up of kind of continued enforcement of state constitutional law is just as important as the continued enforcement of the protections of the federal constitution.
I'm sure our colleague Anthony Sanders would be happy to hear you discuss that. Anthony is out of our Minnesota office and the head of our Center for Judicial Engagement. And for the past several weeks, and I think for many weeks more, is going to be tweeting about the history of the state constitutional protections in all 50 states. And he likes to emphasize that in many states, the constitutional protections are much stronger under the state constitution than under the federal constitution, and that attorneys who are thinking about bringing civil rights claims or other claims against the government for abuse of power should really think first about state constitutional protections before they start looking to potential federal constitutional claims.
Kirby, so we won in the trial court on the vagueness claim. That got reversed in the appeals court, and now it's up to Maryland's highest court. And so we have these two different claims, the law of the land claim, which is a bigger ask. And then there's the vagueness claim. The court could just, we could just win on the vagueness claim. Could you explain why exactly the law is so vague? If in fact we have a map that shows where we can't, where food vendors can and cannot practice, how do we know that the law is vague?
Right. So the law, as I mentioned at the beginning, it is specifically targeting mobile food vendors who sell the same type of food product as the restaurants that they are parked near. And the evidence in the courts below is overwhelming that Baltimore, the officials in Baltimore themselves just didn't know how to interpret that. And it isn't entirely clear what that means, the same type of food product. There are some, you know, comical illustrations of this talking about, for example, I think it's called the cube rule. And it's you know, how many sides of starch are in this product and what kind of starch. And that comes to the result that a calzone, because it could have three sides of starch, is actually a taco. So can you not have a pizza or calzone sandwich mobile vendor near a Mexican restaurant or a taco shop? And, you know, that's kind of a comical illustration, but it is not entirely obvious how to determine who's selling the same kind of food. And obviously, it's really subject to manipulation by enforcers, depending on the political power of the restaurants who don't want the mobile food units near their restaurants.
And it's also subject, I think, to manipulation by the restaurants. If you know that, you know, food trucks are prohibited from serving anywhere near your restaurant, if you offer a similar type of food product to what they have, you might have an incentive to add something to your menu that in some manner resembles what's being sold at the food truck in order to get them pushed, you know, much further away from your restaurant. Even if, you know, they're totally different types of food, if the inspectors are going to apply these crazy rules, you could probably offer something on your menu that, although no normal person would think, oh, yeah, this is a taco, is close enough for government work, as they say.
So that's the vagueness claim. There's also this law of the land claim. In the last 30, 40 years, Maryland is kind of backed away from kind of the broad, strong protections that it used to uphold in the past. So we're asking for sort of a return to the classical interpretation.
That's right. I mean, there are a few cases in more recent years where the courts have been showing discretion to legislatures and saying, you know, this might be a little problematic, but we trust the legislature here. We're not going to find that a right has been violated or that the law of the land clause has been violated. But as you mentioned, there's a much, much deeper and richer history of active enforcement of this clause, and the history of, as I mentioned before, the framing of this clause and the framing of this provision of the Declaration of Rights really shows that it was intended to be a robust protection of liberties, including the right to pursue one's chosen trade.
Okay. Dan, let's move on to the last case, which is also an IJ case. Usually we don't exclusively talk about IJ cases on this podcast, but I just thought these ones were cool, and so heck, we'll throw them in.
Sure. So this case is Salgado v. United States. We just filed a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court last week. This is a case about the right of someone who has had their property wrongly seized for civil forfeiture at the federal level, having a right to attorney's fees if they actually prevail in the case. In this case, Mulata Salgado had $15,000 seized after the DEA raided her house based on a false tip by a confidential informant. They were actually looking for drugs and other things that were supposed to be associated with her husband. It turns out there was no evidence of anything, but they raided the house, seized all the cash, and the case went on for 2 years. Now, Mulata's, you know, ultimately the DEA agent admitted he had absolutely no evidence that either Mulata or her ex-husband had any illegal activity, were involved in any illegal activity, no connection to the cash for any illegal activity. But what the government did after litigating the case for 2 years is it asked the court to voluntarily dismiss the case without prejudice. And that's really crucial under the law for civil forfeiture at the federal level, because CAFRA, the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act, says that if you substantially prevail in your litigation to get back your property, you're entitled to attorney's fees. But the courts have interpreted substantially prevail to mean that a court has to dismiss a forfeiture case with prejudice, meaning the case can't be filed again in order for someone to be a substantially prevailing party and be eligible for attorney's fees. Now, in this particular case, the court actually had summary judgment briefing before it showing that this DEA agent had admitted in a deposition that there was no evidence against Melodis or her ex-husband. And the agent, that testimony pretty much sealed the deal in terms of the government being unable to prevail in the case. So the court ordered that if the government were to refile the case, it would be responsible for the legal expenses of Melodis and or her ex-husband. So effectively, the court was kind of trying to dismiss the case with prejudice. But what it says in the order is that the case was dismissed without prejudice. And as a result, Melodis is not entitled to the return of her attorney's fees. Here's what that means as a practical matter. The $15,000 that she had in her closet was intended for her daughter's quinceañera. Unfortunately, that quinceañera, her daughter's 15th birthday, has already come and gone, and so there will be no quinceañera. She has been entitled to the return of about two-thirds of that money by the court's order because she entered into a contingency fee agreement with her original attorney saying, you get one-third of whatever I recover. And so right now, about $5,000 of the $15,000 is in her attorney's account waiting for resolution by the court. And if the court orders the attorney's fees to be paid by the government, and by the court I mean the Supreme Court, then she will be entitled to be made whole by the payment of those fees. But as it stands now, even though she prevailed in the case, she only gets back $10,000 of the $15,000 that was originally seized from her.
As a legal matter, I think one of the most interesting things that we argue in our briefing is that under this interpretation of the word substantially prevail, it requires actually more to substantially prevail than just to prevail, which just seems obviously the opposite of the intent of the framers of CAFRA. You know, the whole point and motivation of CAFRA was to provide more protections against civil forfeiture abuses. And, you know, that's just such an absurd outcome that it's really seems unjustifiable here. On a more, you know, on the more human side of the case, I just think the details like that you see, like you see in these forfeiture cases, like that she had to cancel her daughter's quinceañera because they took this money from her. It's just so heartbreaking and something that you see time and time again as an IJ attorney investigating these forfeiture cases is the real life impact that this has on the people who find themselves in this really inscrutable and difficult process, and how it affects their lives is really heartbreaking.
Absolutely. And I think it also showcases who is frequently the victim of these civil forfeiture practices. Melodis Salgado is not a wealthy woman. She works at a shop in the airport, at the Miami airport, works currently two different jobs in order to provide for her family. The $15,000 was money she had saved up and received as gifts from relatives to prepare for her daughter's quinceañera. And this was basically her life savings. She wasn't able to afford to hire an attorney outright, so she did so on a contingency fee basis, hoping to get back the money and, frankly, hoping that if she prevailed, she would be eligible for payment of attorney's fees to be made whole under CAFRA. And I think you made a good point, Kirby, about the history of this. The Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act was passed in 2000. It was designed to be a reform of even more abusive federal civil forfeiture practices prior to that. And this specific provision was designed to make whole people who are found to have had their property wrongfully seized. And of course, substantially prevail is a lower standard than prevail. And the reason for having that standard in a civil forfeiture case is you don't always get all of your property back. The government, the court may find that the government is entitled to keep some of it, but so long as you substantially prevail and are able to obtain the return of a substantial portion of what was seized, you are entitled to attorney's fees. But unfortunately, if the if the court dismisses the case without prejudice, and the government could theoretically file the case again, even if, you know, under these facts, obviously the government would never try that again, then people aren't entitled to attorney's fees and end up being victimized a second time by the government's actions.
Dan, I understand why the government would want this case dismissed without prejudice, because that means they don't have to pay attorney's fees and they get to hold on to all this money for 2 years and drag it out. But I don't understand why the court allowed that, why the district court allowed that in this situation.
Well, I don't think I understand quite why the court did that either. There were some unique circumstances in this case related to Melodis' ex-husband and a business of his having a separate contract dispute that the court sort of took as an excuse to resolve this case quickly in order to free up the seized money to satisfy the judgment in this other case. But Melodis' money had nothing to do with that. And she ends up being sort of the innocent victim of the government's tactics here, you know, moving to dismiss the case without prejudice. The court obviously thought there was a good reason not to refile the case, since it threatened sanctions, monetary sanctions, if the government refiled. So it was trying to create something that effectively was like a dismissal with prejudice, but because those magic words weren't there, the court held that she wasn't eligible for attorney's fees. This raises sort of the second question that's presented in our cert petition, which is whether it is an abuse of discretion for a district court to dismiss a case without prejudice in circumstances like this, where it's ordering the money to be returned. It's clear the case will never be refiled. We argue that it is, that you know, courts have to, if this substantially prevailed standard really does mean you have to have a case dismissed with prejudice in order to get attorney's fees, then you know, claimants, property owners, are entitled to a dismissal with prejudice so that they can get their attorney's fees. And that courts that fail to consider that issue and just dismiss the case without prejudice are actually harming those property owners.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice telling you, like your grandma always does, to get engaged.